I know that you must be very tired, and I'm actually not as tired as probably you are. But I have so much information to give you, and for me the most important part will be talking about step 12, because that's about changing the way we carry the message, or at least really questioning how we carry the message in a way. I've had so many good Ask a Basket questions. I am happy if anyone goes to the website, there's a link there to contact me by email. If anyone has any particular questions, I'm more than happy to correspond with them. Just a few Ask a Basket questions before I talk about step 10. When I make amends, do I tell people that I'm working in OA? Yes. I'll talk more about that later, but I do. The big book says that, and I do it. There's a question about times and how quickly this whole thing says. How long does this whole process take from step 5? I mean, step 5 can take 2, 3, 4 hours. I would say that step 6 and 7 are done right away in minutes. You contemplate what you're doing, you're serious about it, but then you just do them. And then step 8, well, the form, I'm glad they asked that question. The form is there, and the form is not all big book. But it's just a suggestion. You write down the person, then you write down the harm you've done. Until you know the harm you've done to a person, you have no idea what amends you have to make. What is the harm you've done to a person who hurt you? It may be you let them hurt you, and therefore did let them do harm to themselves. Or it may be that you didn't tell other people that this person has harmed you. I haven't given any examples of amends. I just don't have time for that. But I've had 3 friends who were sexually assaulted badly. Each of them took a different approach to the amends. One of them said, when she looked over, when she reviewed it, she said, the man is over 90 years old. He's dying absolutely alone, penniless. There's nothing I have to do. He is dying the life he led, and I'm not going to make any more. I'm not going to do anything more. Another one went to the police to report a rape that occurred many, many years before. And a third one announced at the family gathering that this man, this uncle whom everyone likes, molested me when I was a child, and I'm not letting my children next to him. And if I were you, I wouldn't let others. And somebody said, well, what kind of amends is that? And the answer is, as simple as, if your child were about to walk off the edge of a cliff, would you not grab his arm? And even if it broke his arm, wouldn't that be better than letting him die? And therefore, sometimes to keep a person from doing greater harm, you do lesser harm. So each of them had an answer. Now, I have to tell you that that is not the only answer that I might have thought of, or not the only answer that someone else in their circumstances might have thought of. What is important is it's what they thought of and what came to them at the time, and what they, after prayer, came to the conclusion was the appropriate amends to make. I've come to different conclusions at different times about amends I owe to people. And I've been asked by a person, you know, I have this major issue that is really bothering me. What do I do about it? What kind of amends can I make? It's really hard. And it sounds very hard. And my answer is, I go back and I would put on step 4, not just my worry about the amends. I would put down the individuals who are all involved in that. I would put down the issue. I would put down all kinds. I would really put down almost everything I could on the resentment list of step 4. I'd work it through all the way through column 2, column 3, column 4. I'd figure out where I've been selfish, dishonest, self-seeking, frightened in relation to each one of those things. Then I'd look at my fears, because I would have many fears. You know, sometimes amends require a disclosure of things that would be quite embarrassing or quite humiliating at times. It happens. I'd write down, I'm afraid of saying this, I'm afraid of doing that, I'm afraid of doing nothing, all the fears there. And you work that through in the fear thing of, you know, why does this bother me? Why do I feel these fears? Am I relying on my finite self? And if a God does it work, what would God, you say the prayer, what would God have me be? And at that point, and then I do a step 5 on that. And after getting all that kind of work on that and getting the feedback that I get and saying the prayer at step 7, because obviously I want to get rid of these defects of character, then I would be in a position to understand the harm I've done to others, and much better position to understand how to make amends for that harm. I would then, if it was a real big deal, check it out with maybe two or three people who are recovered in the program, or who might be able to provide another perspective. I've done step fives with people who are experts in particular fields. I was thinking about changing a job once, and I did a step five on changing that with a close friend of mine who is a psychologist, who is a counselor, a career counselor as well. So I did my step five with him because I knew he would provide me with feedback that I needed that I couldn't get from the person I normally gave step five to. So I would use these forms and do step 4, 5, 6, 7, and 8, and then I would know what kind of amends and whether I would make them. Okay? So I just, you know, and because the amends you make are what ultimately feels right in your heart. And that depends on where you are. And sometimes you'll persuade yourself, and I'd always get feedback from another person, that you can't make this amends right now because it would harm other people. Sometimes you'd be wrong. And then you would start to hit again, or you'd start to really worry, and you'd do what I'm about to tell you, do a step 10, and you'd realize you were wrong. I've made amends that have turned out not to be the right kind of amends. I've learned from that. You know, anyway, the form itself is the person, the harm you've done, the nature. So the harm you've done, once you know the harm you've done, then you know the kind of amends you can make. You look through all of them, you get feedback, you maybe ask a sponsor or someone with a lot more experience. Are these the only amends you can think of? Are there maybe other amends you might be able to think of? And then that's basically from the big book concept. And then you've got three different columns which are well known in the program. I'm ready to do this amends now. I'll do this sometimes. I'll never do it. And then the idea is you do all the ones that are in the first column that you're ready to do now, and by magic, the ones in the sometimes column turn into the now column, the ones in the never turn into the sometimes. And then you do all the ones that are in the now column, then the ones that used to be in the never, that were in the sometimes, become in the now. I mean, that's what happens, because the moment you make amends of any kind, you feel free. And so you realize you want to feel even freer and freer and freer. And the consequences of not making amends become worse than the consequences of making amends. But for really difficult ones, I would always get feedback, and I have always got feedback. I've always gone to other people for assistance just to make sure that I was doing the right thing. You know? You know, I have another ex-girlfriend who's living in a city I'm about to visit, whom I haven't seen for over 40 years. We parted on very good terms. There's one part in which I don't think I treated her well. One little part. No big deal. It happened. And I haven't had any contact with her. And I actually did this with my wife, because my wife is full of common sense. And she said, why would you parachute yourself into the life of someone you don't even know? You don't know what her circumstances are. You don't know anything. And what are you going to end up saying to her? You know, this one particular moment, either she won't remember it and then relive it, or she'll remember it and not want to remember it, you know. So it's not worth it, and I'm not going to see her. And I think that's probably wise, you know. So, I don't have easy answers, but that's it. So that's that question. I have so many wonderful questions. Many of the questions are about sponsoring and relapse and how you deal with sponsees, and I'll address that when I get to step 11. Many of those questions are like that. What I want to do is talk about step 10, and there's only one paragraph because it didn't exist in the original six steps, but it happens to be... Remember I told you there were two mistakes I made, and that's why I relapsed? The first mistake I made for 6 or 7 years, the first mistake I made was not accepting that my body had allergic reactions, got these cravings, so I wanted to be able to eat everything in moderation. The second mistake I made was not to understand what step 10 meant. I read it on the wall we say on the wall, meaning just what we read at every meeting. Continue to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. Well, first of all, inventory is only mentioned in step four, so I thought that meant I would do a step four, in a sense. And I said, when I was wrong, promptly admitted it, so if I yelled at my children, I would admit it, and I'd apologize. I wouldn't do anything more. And ultimately, I went back to eating. Even if I had not been eating the trigger foods, I went back to that because my mind would send me back. It took, once I started to study the big book after 6 or 7 years and listen to Blaine, this man in Winnipeg, who is a brilliant big book scholar, or student, a scholar, I'd say, who said step 10 is steps 4 through 9 done over again. You don't do step 4 through 9 again. You've finished with steps 1 through 9 because you have recovered. It's finished. You've changed. Now you have to keep it. You know, the promises I read to you, we're neither cocky nor are we afraid. We haven't even sworn off. The problem's been removed. It says that is how we react so long as we keep in fit spiritual condition. Well, what I did not realize, for instance, when I was yelling at my children, was that between the time I did my step 9, let's say I made my final amends on December the 31st, 2012, and it's now September the 21st, 22nd, 2013, there have been 9 months of past. Things have happened over the last 9 months. And what I did not realize was I had to continue to clean the past the same way I cleaned the past up to then. So I have to continue to do steps 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, and 9 in order to make sure that I make amends for whatever has happened up to now, between the time I last made amends and up to now. And that's what step 10 says in the big book. It says on page 84, paragraph 4, on page 97, the Danish version. This thought brings us to step 10, which suggests we continue to take personal inventory and continue to set right any new mistakes as we go along. We vigorously commence this way of living as we cleaned up the past, as we did steps 4 through 9. We have entered the world of the Spirit, so we're now recovered. We now have sanity. Sanity has returned. We're now recovered compulsive eaters. Our next function is to grow in understanding and effectiveness. This is not an overnight matter. It should continue for our lifetime. Continue to watch for selfishness, dishonesty, resentment, and fear. Not exactly the same words, but as close as you're ever going to get to what we did in step 4. When these crop up, we ask God at once to remove them, step 6 and 7. We discuss them with someone immediately, step 5, and make amends quickly if we've harmed anyone. Not admitted, continue to take personal inventory when we're wrong promptly. But not just admit it, but make amends, which is far deeper than admitting it. So when I was yelling at my children and apologizing to them over and over again, I was not looking at the entire life I was living. I was not looking at the fact that my mother was getting sick and my father was taking care of her and there were problems there and that my in-laws whom I loved were both sick and my sister-in-law whom I loved was sick. That was not in my vision. I was just yelling at my kids, and so I apologized to them. But when I realized that step 10 meant I did a step 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, and 9, but I'm not doing a step 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, and 9. I've recovered. I'm doing a step 10. I take out the forms. I write out my resentments. I write out my fears. I write out my sex conduct. And frankly, I now use that sex conduct form now that I've recovered. I can use it for any relationship as well. Because now in step 10 I can refine it. Remember, the big book says in step 4, now that you've made an inventory of your grosser handicaps, the big ones, now we can fine tune it, if you will. We can look at it in more detail. So I do step 10 to make any decision that I need to make, whether it's to change jobs, whether it's what's going on in my life, whether I should, I've made suggestions, people don't know whether they need an operation or whether they should take the risk of having a serious operation. I don't have any answers. Do a step 10 on it. Sponsees phone me up. What do I do about this particular situation? I don't know. Do a step 10 on it. I don't make any decisions without doing step 10. What I've learned from this is that what step 10 does is as we work through the, as I work through the forms, I get rid of all the bad motivations, all the selfishness, dishonesty, self-seeking, and fear. And I begin to focus on how I can be useful to others in making whatever decision I have to make. And I can tell you how powerful it is. When I was trying to deciding whether to change jobs, it took me about a year, maybe a year and a half, of step 10s. Because the first few step 10s I did made me understand how really good the job I had was. And then the next set of step 10s made me think about what possibilities there were for changing and having an even better line of work. And then the next set of step 10s led me to understand that I had to get trained for that line of work. I couldn't just go into it without some certification. And then the next set of step 10s said, well, I've really got to discuss this with my wife because it would mean a tremendous financial change in our lives. And we discussed that very, very much so. And I had to discuss with others to see whether it was even a reasonable alternative, whether I had a chance of making money in that job because I owe a responsibility to my family to earn some money. And so the step 10s really helped me during this time. There is a difference between, as I see it, step 10 and step 11, the evening meditation. I'll get to that in a moment. But any time... I have 12, I love 12, I have 12 checkpoints as to whether I do a step 10. The first three come from the doctor's opinion. Am I restless? Am I irritable? Am I discontented? If one of those three is my case, I've got to do a step 10. And then the next eight come from what are called the bedevilments in We Agnostics. Found on page 52 of the Big Book or page 70, paragraph 1 in the Danish edition. We were having trouble with personal relationships. We couldn't control our emotional natures. We were prey to misery and depression. We couldn't make a living. We had a feeling of uselessness. We were full of fear. We were unhappy. We couldn't seem to be of real help to other people. Those are eight. Eight plus three is 11. The 12th one is food becoming an issue? Am I beginning to eat a bit more? Is my belly button moving up a bit? You know, because remember, I eat up to my belly button. Is it beginning to move up a bit? Am I gaining weight? People ask me how often I weigh myself. I don't weigh myself that often. But if I begin to feel tight, if I begin to think, realize that I'm taking too much weight, it's time for me to do a step 10. I've been abstinent, but it's still time for me to do a step 10 because I clearly am, something's going on in my life. I have a 13th one, which is, if my sponsees or my wife or my children tell me it's time to do a step 10, I do it. That's the bottom line. I should have done a step 10 a long time ago. I have refined step 10. I don't know if you have this saying in your countries, but in the United States and Canada, it is only professionals should do this, or don't do this if you're an amateur. Don't do this at home. So now that we're professionals, now that we've done steps 4 through 9 and we've recovered, I do more in step 10. There was one time where my wife was really big on my resentment list, and I had a list of maybe 20 things in column 2 of things that were bothering me. Well, what I decided to do, I would take those 20 things and put them each as a separate resentment in column 1 rather than have them as a whole list of resentments in column 2. So each one of the resentments I had against her became a simple resentment. Each of the causes in column 2, I moved them over to column 1. So I now had 20 resentments relating to her, and I was able to ask, why am I feeling that resentment? So I was able to go into much more depth, and it was amazing. I mean, I wouldn't suggest this at all for step 4, but for the step 10, it was really powerful. So I highly recommend that, but only to be used by the professional, by the recovered compulsive eater. And again, the sex conduct form can easily be adapted to all relationships, not just sex conduct relationships, in step 10. I don't advise doing that for step 4, but in step 10. And I do it, you know, to this day. I do a step 4, I do a step 5. Sometimes, I will just pick the last recovered person who is about to leave my meeting. I say, I need 10 minutes from you. Mm-hmm. And just do a step 5. It doesn't take long because... You know, most of my insights, I know what I'm going to say. I know what's going on. I mean, once I do the step 4, it's pretty clear. But I do share it in step 5. I've done them with my wife. I've done them with my friends. because it's really become almost commonplace for me. And then I say the step 7 prayer. I don't have to spend any time on step 6. It's pretty obvious what I have to do, get rid of the defects of character. And then I figure out the amends I have to make. Thankfully, almost all of them are living amends. I really haven't had many apologies to make, and I certainly haven't cheated or stolen from anyone, but they're often just living amends, and they're ways of getting rid of the fears and the anxieties that I have. I cannot emphasize this enough. The sponsees I have had who have recovered at step 9 and then relapsed afterwards have generally not done step 10. They failed to look at the symptoms of restless, irritable, and discontented. They have thought that they don't have to do any step 10s, and they relapsed, even though I have emphasized to them how important step 10 is. That's generally what I want to say about step 10. But I've been asked by a few people, does your food change? Does your God change? Do things change? Well, yes, they do. And I do a step 10 on them. You know, I will often, sometimes my food changes. I've added to the food I no longer eat. I have a friend, though, who uses these forms to decide whether there's food he can take back. For some reason, he had not been eating pistachios. I don't know if that is a meaningful word. For 25 years, and after 25 years of abstinence and tremendous recovery, far, far better than mine, or more spiritual than mine, he did this kind of work on pistachios and decided he would try them. And now he has a few pistachios whenever he feels like it, which is not that often, and pistachios don't seem to bother him. I'm not going to take that chance with butter, I can tell you, or with ice cream. I'm never going to take that chance. But I don't experiment. But I do. Has my God changed? Not really. I think I just said it did change, but not really. My God has not changed. It's still truth, love, justice, and beauty. It still has no personality. It still does nothing in this world other than stand as an ideal for me. But I would use step 10 to look at, to see whether it changes. I use step 10 for everything. And I've never, ever found it to be wanting. I've made mistakes. My amends have not, at times, turned out well. But I have known that they were the right amends at the time, so I don't regret them. I learned from them. And it's that simple. So I really recommend step 10.
You forgot a very important thing in step 10. As it says, then we resolutely turn our thoughts to someone we can help.
Okay, it says, it points out that we resolutely turn our thoughts to someone we can help, but that I'm going to emphasize in step 12, we do all the time. But it is true that we think of others rather than ourselves. Okay, so that's basically step 10. I think I've answered that question. How do I know when it's God's will and when it's my will? I know that through steps 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, and 9, or through step 10. And I have no other answer to that question. When I've taken away all my own motivations, all the selfish, dishonest, self-seeking, and fear, and I'm focusing on making amends to others, I know in my heart, and when I've done a step 5 on that, and I've poured out my heart to another human being, and when I've prayed that God remove all my defects of character in step 7, when I make my list and I get feedback on the difficult ones, I know it's God's will. I know it in my heart. And that's the only answer I can say. Okay. Page 85, paragraph 2, page 98 of the Danish edition. It is easy to let up on the spiritual program of action and rest on our laurels. We're headed for trouble if we do, for alcohol is a subtle foe. We are not cured of alcoholism. What we really have is a daily reprieve, and a reprieve is a suspension of a death sentence. A daily reprieve contingent that's conditional on the maintenance of our spiritual condition. Every day is a day when we must carry the vision of God's will into all of our activities. How can I best serve thee? Thy will, not mine, be done. These are thoughts which must go with us constantly. We can exercise our willpower along this line all we wish. It's the proper use of the will. We get our will back because we are now doing God's will, not our will. And the big book then starts to talk about step 11. And it says, we could be vague about this, but we do have some definite suggestions. The big book suggestions are completely unlike, as I said earlier, what we now think about as meditation. They are basically practical guides to the useful life. That's what they are. They are summarized. You have a sheet that gives you all the prayers to be said for the evening, the morning, and daytime, during the day. And they are very simple, and they're practical, and they don't require a great deal of time at all. At night, we review our day, and we view it constructively. We see how well we did so we can do better tomorrow. And we just go through the day, and we ask the same kinds of questions that we would ask in step 10 or step 4. Where was I selfish, dishonest, resentful, and fearful? And you look at that. And then, if you have to, you call someone up, because you may have to share that with someone. You may have to make amends. Those are the questions you ask. There are other questions as well. And Blaine, you know, the person who had a great influence on me, believes that that means you do step 10 every night. I don't think it means that. I see that differently. I see what these step 11 suggestions are, very similar to the step 10 suggestions, but I think differently. From my point of view, step 11, I do every night. I don't do every night. I should do every night. Is I do it in bed, and I think it through. I don't write it down. And the way I read it, it is, if we have to talk to someone, we talk to someone, whereas in step 10 it says we do talk to someone. So I see the distinction. But at any rate, I can only give you my best example is when my mother was quite ill. She had a stroke about 3 or 4 years before she died, and she was the person who took care of everyone else. She was a very loving, wonderful mother, and now she had to be taken care of, and she couldn't stand it. She was so unhappy that other people had to take care of her. She was in a wheelchair, and my father was taking care of her, and she couldn't stand that because she used to take care of my father. So she was very unhappy. Every night, I would think about how well I had dealt with my father and my mother that day. Had I gone to visit them? Had I spoken to them? They lived in the same city, so I would often see them. And if not see them, I would speak to them every day. And I would, how was the conversation? How did I do? Did I show love? Those are the questions I would ask at the end of every day. But as it turned out, every week, as I remember, I mean, it's been a long time, but every week, I would do a step 10 on my father and my mother. I write down my father. And what I'd write down in column 2 in the resentment form would be things that I hadn't thought of on a daily basis, like, is he going to die before she will? Because he's lifting her, and he's older than she is. Is he going to resent taking care of her? Is their relationship going to go bad? They loved each other so much. Is he going to get angry at her? You know, she can't speak as much. Is the shine, the wonderful brilliance that she would bring in her conversation and her love, that she can't show much anymore, is that going to mean that he's going to reject her more? And with my mother, is she so depressed that she might want to commit suicide? You know, how can I, you know what I'm saying? Like, these were much deeper than what I would think about on a daily basis, and I'd write them out. And as I'd write one thing down, more would come out. So I learned more from the step 10 I did once a week, and then I did step 5, 6, 7, 8, and 9 on that. But I'm just saying that was the deep stuff dealing with what was going on my entire life. And of course, once I wrote my father and mother down, I'd write down my children, I'd write down my wife, because all these things would be affecting my relationships with them. So step 10 was for me the sometimes I would do it once a week because of the pressures in my own life, and sometimes I would do them once a year, because it just depends on what's going on in my life and whether my step 11 is taking care of most of the things or whether things are building up in me. If I'm restless, irritable, and discontented, clearly step 11, the way I do it, wasn't doing a good enough job. Now, Blaine may have been able to do this every day, and I can't. He would phone his sponsor, he'd share it, he'd make amends. I haven't done that. Maybe people who are more spiritual than I am have discovered the secret that you do step 10 every night. I don't know. But that's how I see the difference. Step 10 gives me the perspective. Step 11 is daily. And the way it's written, you can see that it really is, how can I do better tomorrow? How did I do today? How can I learn from what I did today to do better tomorrow? In the morning, we direct our thoughts to the day ahead. And there are certain prayers to be said. We say those prayers and we think about it. The brilliance of this is if we don't know what we're going to do, we ask, we say a prayer, God, please help me, what is it? God, please give me inspiration and a shoot of thought or a decision. And then the advice is, relax, take it easy, don't struggle, do whatever comes to your mind. And they say, over, and the promise is that over a period of time, our thinking will be more on a spiritual plane, we will begin to react sanely and normally, and our hunches and our inspirations will be right. Not always, we may fool ourselves sometimes, but gradually as we place our reliance on our inspiration, we don't have to work everything through. And I found that to be true. I'm still very bad at this, but I have found, generally speaking, that the inspiration works. As a lawyer, I used to stay up half the night preparing for a cross-examination, and then I wouldn't be that good because I'd be so tired. What was the right question to begin with? You know, if he says this, I'll say this. If she, you know. And when I started working the steps and saw this advice, I would just say, whatever comes to my mind will be the first question. You know, I find that 9 times out of 10, I always ask the right question. It began to be, I mean, some of you might say, oh, God was inspiring you, you just don't accept it. That's God acting anonymously. I appreciate that, and I don't make fun of that. For me, it was just, I was so open to possibilities that that any question would have been the right question, because the next question, I would have made up for any problems in the next question. But as it was, I slept better. And when you sleep better, you do a better job. So the promise here is that we will become much more directly attuned to our higher power. The blockage has been removed, and we can learn to rely on the direct pipeline between our heart and our head. That's the great promise of step 11. And if you rely, if you begin to relax and take it easy, as you plan your day, you will find this to be true. And there are instructions there. It's all in that form. I'm not going to go into any great detail there. And then there are the daily meditations. These are the meditations that if something crops up and something's bothering you, what do you do? And I don't know if you remember the mantra, the concept of the mantra. The mantra is a prayer that you say over and over and over again that relaxes you. They give you your mantras here. I'm no longer running the show. I'm no longer running the show. I'm no longer running the show. Thy will not mine be done. Thy will not mine be done. Thy will not mine be done. And there have been times in my life, especially when I was practicing law against a particular lawyer, I would say, I'm no longer running the show. I'm no longer running the show. I'm no longer running the show. Thy will not mine be done. I will not mine be done. And finally I'd say, okay, I'm no longer running the show. Thy will not mine be done. And I'd be relaxed and I'd go back into the hearing. So it's really a wonderful way, and the Big Book promises it works. It really does on page 88 or paragraph 1 of page 101 of the Danish edition. And I could say a lot more about this, but you've got the form, and I'm just going to go on. It's 11:15. I've got 45 minutes now, and I will have an hour after lunch, and I plan to use that to discuss step 11. By the way, I mean, if you feel that I've gone too quickly over some of these things, given that you're all very tired anyway, the book that I've written that's available on oabigbook.info has all this information and a lot more, along with pictures, photographs. Now, a whole bunch of questions on working with others. And the Big Book says, right at the end of the chapter, Into Action, page 88 and paragraphs 2 and 3 of page 101, Danish edition. We alcoholics are undisciplined, so we let God discipline us in the simple way we've just outlined. But this is not all. There is action and more action. Faith without works is dead. They keep reminding us about that. That we can't, you know, just praying is nothing if we don't take action. The next chapter is entirely devoted to step 12. And many people have pointed out that chapter 7, working with others, is not the only chapter devoted to step 12. All the rest of the chapters are devoted to step 12, living according to the principles of the program. The next chapter is to the wives, a very difficult chapter for many people to read, but it contains a lot of good information, as patronizingly as it is written. After that is to the employer, the family afterwards, how to live with your family. The next is to the employer, how to be a good employee, or how to be a good employer, and thus how to be a good employee. And then a vision for you, which I will be addressing. But I want to spend most time on working with others, carrying the message to the compulsive eater who still suffers. And with that in mind, I want to start off with another text. And this is taken from AA literature. These are all ask a basket questions. I have to answer that question. These are two pamphlets from Alcoholics Anonymous. One of them is from Dr. Bob. His last major speech that he gave in 1948. He gave his last speech was he was dying. He gave a very short speech in Cleveland, Ohio, in 1950, where he stressed the simplicity of the program. He said, "Let's not louse it all up with Freudian complexes and things that are interesting to the scientific mind, but have little to do with our actual AA work." This is a lesson that Joe and Charlie say AA did not learn, and things became much more complex in AA, and they forgot the simple message of the big book. I can't comment on that, but that's what Joe and Charlie said. Anyway, this is what Dr. Bob says in his last major speech. You can listen to a recording of this. There's a wonderful website, xa-speakers.org. I know many of you have been there. It has many, many wonderful AA speakers. Including some of the historical ones. So this is what Dr. Bob said. He said, "I said I was quite human, and I get to thinking every once in a while that this guy Bob is rather a smart individual. He's got this liquor situation right by the tail, proved it and demonstrated it, hasn't had a drink for over 13 years, probably could knock off a couple and no one would be the wiser." And people laughed at this point in the speech. He says, "I tell you, I'm not trying to be funny. Those thoughts actually do enter my mind. And the minute they do, I know exactly what has happened. You see, in Akron, we have the extreme good fortune to have a very nice setup at St. Thomas Hospital. The ward theoretically accommodates 7 alcoholics, but the good Sister Ignatia sees that it's stretched a little bit. She usually has 2 or more others parked around somewhere. Just as soon as that idea that I could probably polish off a couple enters my mind, I think, this is the way these guys talk, how about the boys in the ward? You've been giving them the semi-brush-off for the last few days. A brush-off is not paying them much attention, ignoring them. You'd better get back on the job, big boy, before you get into trouble." And I pat her right back, meaning sort of walking with little steps, and I am much more attentive than I had been before I got the funny idea. But I do get it every once in a while, and I'll probably go on getting it whenever I get careless about seeing the boys in the ward. Any time I neglected them, I was thinking more of Bob than I was of the ward. I wasn't being especially loving. Those fellows had come there indicating their desire for help, and I was just a little too busy to give them much of my time, as if they'd been panhandling on the street, begging on the streets. Don't want to be bothered with a fellow 10 cents to get rid of him. Well, that's easy. He could even stand 2 bits, a quarter. Not because you love the fellow, but just to be relieved of the nuisance of his hanging on your coat sleeve. No unselfishness, no love at all indicated in that transaction. I think the kind of service that really counts is giving of yourself, and that almost invariably always requires effort and time. It isn't a matter of just putting a little quiet money in the dish. That's needed, but it isn't giving much for the average individual in days like these when most people get along fairly well. I don't believe that type of giving would ever keep anyone sober. But giving of our own effort and strength and time is quite a different matter. I think that's what Bill learned in New York, and I didn't learn in Akron until we met." So that's an indication of Dr. Bob's dedication to carrying the message. He, in his 15 years of sobriety, I think it was 15, ministered to 5,000 alcoholics free of charge, helped them medically, helped them in the hospitals. He gave of his time all the time. He was truly a saint. And the humility of the man, when he was dying, Bill went to see him, and Bill writes about this, and said, "You know, the boys have been putting together, been passing the hat around to buy a really good tombstone for you. You know, talking about what role you played." And he said, I always get emotional when I think about this because I don't have that humility. And Dr. Bob said, "You know, I just want to die like a normal person. I don't want my name to be put on. And in the book that I've written, you can see a picture of both Dr. Bob's and Bill's gravestone that doesn't even mention the role they played in Alcoholics Anonymous. They saved millions of people's lives, and they don't even mention that on their gravestone. Of course, there are a lot of rocks. There are a lot of serenity prayers that you'll find if you go to the gravestones, I imagine. But their gravestone don't even mention them. Tremendously humble man. And yet... Oh, and I read one other thing from his... story, Dr. Bob's nightmare. Just at the end of that story, page 180 of the big book, or page 175, paragraph 7. I spend a great deal of time passing on what I learned to others who want and need it badly. I do it for four reasons. One, sense of duty. Two, it is a pleasure. It's true. Three, because in so doing, I am paying my debt to the man who took time to pass it on to me. And think of all of us and the debts we owe, not just to one man, but to dozens of people who have carried the message to us, hundreds of people who have carried the message to us, because we're generations and generations and generations removed from the original people. And we have so many more people to pay your debt to. And then four, because every time I do it, I take out a little more insurance for myself against a possible slip. And the big book says on page 89, page 102 of the Danish edition, paragraph 1, practical experience shows that nothing will so much ensure immunity from drinking as intensive work with other alcoholics. It works when other activities fail. This is our 12th suggestion. Carry this message to other alcoholics. You can help when no one else can. You can secure their confidence when others fail. Remember, they are very ill. Listen to these promises. Life will take on a new meaning. To watch people recover, to see them help others, to watch loneliness vanish, to see a fellowship grow up about you, to have a host of friends. This is an experience you must not miss. We know you will not want to miss it. Frequent contact with newcomers and with each other is the bright spot of our lives. So however you're feeling and whatever depths of misery you may be in, once you recover, you will be a transformed person. You will see how your experience can help others. And if you help others, life will take on a new meaning. It's absolutely true. I'm just trying to think of how to talk about... Oh, I'll talk about this. This is what Dr. Bob said in his last speech. I used to go to the hospital... In my mind, the spirit of service was of prime importance, but I found that it had to be backed up with some knowledge in our subject. I used to go to the hospital and stand there and talk. I talked many a time to a chap in the bed for 5 or 6 hours. I don't know how he ever stood me for 5 or 6 hours, or 12 hours or 15 hours, but he did. We must have hidden his clothes. I can't say that about you. Anyway, it came to me that I probably didn't know too much about what I was saying. We are stewards, trustees, guardians of what we have, and that includes our time. I was not giving a good account of my stewardship of time when it took me 6 hours to say something to this man that I could have said in an hour if I had known what I was talking about. I certainly was not a very efficient individual. And I take that very seriously, that it is important that I know how to carry the message and how to carry it efficiently. I give you this challenge. Not right now, I'm not asking you to do it, but think about this. Could you, in 5 minutes, grab the attention of the compulsive eater who still suffers, explain what the problem is, and explain what the solution is? I think I can. I've worked hard to do that. I mean, obviously I've spent a lot of time talking, but I think I could do it. I have done it. I could talk about the allergy of the body. I wouldn't use the word allergy anymore. Obsession I still would use. But I could talk about the cravings. I would talk about my own experiences very briefly. And I would explain how the steps changed my approach to my mind. I would talk about the mental problem. I think someday, if you ever wanted to have a good 1 or 2 hour exercise at some intergroup or convention, get 10 recovered compulsive eaters. Tell them what's going to happen. Put them away from the stage or from the area. And have each one come out and meet someone who is acting as a newcomer and who says, boy, that was a wonderful meeting. I learned so much. But you know what? I have to catch a bus in 5 minutes. Can you just tell me about Overeaters Anonymous? And let each one of those long-timers explain in their own words, tell their story, explain what Overeaters Anonymous is. You will learn so much from the way they tell their story that will help you tell your story. It would be a wonderful experience. You have to give them preparation. You don't want to, you know, surprise them with it, but it would be an extremely wonderful experience. It's very practical and very wonderful. Now, Blaine says, you have to live your life beyond reproach. You may be the only copy of the big book someone else ever sees. I want to talk about our responsibility as recovered people. And I want to talk about the big book's approach to carry the message. There's a new definition of abstinence. It's relatively new. And it says that we abstain from compulsive eating behaviors, and we work towards or maintain a healthy body weight. The emphasis on healthy body weight is relatively new in our program, and yet it really ought to be there. We have to live the life of the big book, and the responsibility of anyone who wants to be a sponsor is to work towards or maintain a healthy body weight. What are people looking for when they come? They're looking for sobriety. They're looking for people who are able to say, I am a model of what I am going to talk to you about. And if you recall, when I first recovered, I hadn't lost the weight I needed to lose. And I had to rethink my eating plan and find out about eating behaviors in order to make certain that I could lose that weight and could carry the message. I've been to too many meetings where people who are grossly overweight, I've been in the program for, 500 years, and I've been absent for, 100 of those years, and this is a wonderful program. And I know the weight will take care of itself. No, it doesn't take care of itself. Faith without works is dead. And there's a responsibility that we all have to carry the message appropriately. At least that's what I think. And I think the new definition of abstinence makes it clear. I had a sponsee who was tremendously overweight who did the steps within 3 months and recovered and was beginning to lose weight, but you could hardly tell she was losing weight because she was so heavy. So she would say, I'm ready to sponsor. I want you to know I am losing weight. I have a long way to go, but I have recovered. I'm ready to help anyone work through the recovery. So she explained her lack of her apparent overweight. Roseanne, our co-founder, came to a World Service Business Conference many years ago. She's not well now and she doesn't come anymore, but she came once and she said, I want you to, and she gave a speech. She said, before I begin this speech, I want you to know I have gained weight. And yet I have been absent. I need to explain this to you so you understand. I'm not fooling myself. I have had cancer. I've had certain chemotherapy. It has killed my metabolism. I have kept eating only what the minimum that my doctor forces me to eat. He has told me that I cannot lose weight in the way I'm doing. I have to eat a certain amount. And with my metabolism, this has put weight on me. He says that eventually it will take care of itself. And that my metabolism will come back. But my gaining weight should not be seen in any way, shape, or form that I am not abstinent and I'm not working the steps. And that was a tremendous statement on her behalf. So I think it's really important to remember that these are our responsibilities. The other thing to understand before we go into the big book's directions is that the big book is tough. It's not nice. You know, as saintly as Dr. Bob was, the Sister Ignatia he spoke about actually gave a talk about Dr. Bob. And she said, he would spend, 24 hours a day carrying the message, going with people. He was a saint. But she said, there were times when he would say to me, kick this guy out. He's not really interested. And that's a toughness that we sure don't see in our program. We are so nice. There's a lot of toughness here, and I want to talk about it. But first of all, I want to talk about how we carry the message. If you remember, and this is the history of AA, if you remember, Ebby brought the message to Bill. How did he do it? Have a drink, Bill says. No thanks, I'm not drinking, says Ebby. What's all this about, says Bill, asks Bill. And Ebby says, I've got religion. And he explains about the Oxford groups, and he explains about, you get honest with yourself, you get honest with another human being, etc., etc. And anyway, Bill then recovers. He then tries for 6 months to sober up anyone he could find. He goes into the barrio, he goes to the missions, he brings them home. He talks and talks and talks to them. Lois comes home from work. She cooks for them. She cleans their clothes. She does the dishes. She cleans the house. And Bill talks and talks and talks and talks and talks. But anyway, let's put Lois to the side. Poor Lois, and she felt very sorry for herself, but she continued to do it. Not one of them recovered. Not one person that Bill talked to recovered. As a matter of fact, one person committed suicide in the house. Another person attacked Lois with a butcher knife, and that same person stole Lois's only good coat. He was having horrible, horrible luck with these alcoholics. He went to see Dr. Silkworth, and he said, "I think I'm going to have to give up this passion of trying to carry the message to others. It just isn't working." And I was thinking of that I'd be creating sort of this whole group of people who would all be helping each other, but it's not working. And Dr. Silkworth gave him some advice. Bill discusses that in two different places. I'm going to read it to you from a pamphlet called Three Talks to Medical Societies. It's an AA pamphlet. And this is a shorter version of the way he puts it in another book. And he says, "Dr. Silkworth pointed out to me that I had forgotten all about deflation at depth. I had simply turned to preacher. Because what Bill was doing what Epi did to him. I don't drink anymore, and let me tell you about this white flash I had." Or he used to call it a hot flash, but I don't know whether a hot flash means the same in your language as that in English. A hot flash refers to what women go through in menopause. So I always get good laughter when I talk about Bill's hot flash, but I suffered through that for some time. So he would talk about this white flash and about God appearing. If there is a God, let him show himself to me now. And people would just sort of walk away. What he had forgotten was that he had spent 3 visits at the town's hospital and had heard Dr. Silkworth speak at length about how he was doomed, because once he started, he couldn't stop, and he couldn't stop from starting again. And he never said that to these people. He just talked about, "I was a drinker, and now I don't drink anymore," and all that. So Dr. Silkworth then said to him, "Why don't you pour the grim medical facts into these people before you do anything else?" And he talks about a book by William James, the great American psychologist, called The Varieties of Religious Experience. He was a philosopher too. Varieties of Religious Experience, which Bill had read in the town's hospital. Ebby brought it to him. And what Bill had learned from that book was that all the great religious spiritual experiences that people have had, the ones that William James documents in this incredibly complex and well-written book, virtually all of them had only one thing in common, that is they came from despair, out of despair. Out of despair came people's spiritual rebirth. At least that's what he read in that. I'm not sure he's entirely correct, but that's what he read into it. So this is what Dr. Silkworth says. "Have you forgotten what William James said about ego deflation at depth? Give them the medical business and give it to them hard. Skip that account of your hot flash. Recite your symptoms extensively so as to get an identification at depth. When you do this, your prospects may become willing to adopt the simple moral precepts you've been trying to preach." So Dr. Silkworth gave him the advice that you start with your story. And you tell your story in such a way that the person realizes you used to be like them, and also begins to understand how doomed, if they're like you, how doomed they are. Because you were doomed. And if you do it that way, then the person will grasp onto the solution that you have to offer. Well, the violins begin again, and it's an emotional moment in when you think about it in our lives. Bill goes with a group of business people to Akron, Ohio. They hope to take over by buying shares in a company that makes machinery for rubber makers and tire makers. Akron at that time was the center of people who made automobile tires and truck tires. They go to Akron, Ohio, and the business deal does not work out. He was to have been a major partner in this, and they lose the battle on the shares, and they leave him. They leave him in Akron, Ohio, alone to see if maybe there was any fraud, any false dealings with the shares in the vote. And he's alone in the Mayflower Hotel. And he describes this in A Vision for You on page 154, page 157 of the Danish version, paragraph 4. Bitterly discouraged, he found himself in a strange place, discredited and almost broke. Still physically weak and sober, but a few months, he saw that his predicament was dangerous. He wanted so much to talk with someone, but whom? One dismal afternoon, he paced the hotel lobby, wondering how his bill was to be paid. And that hotel lobby exists still, but it's now a senior citizen's home. And evidently, if you press the buzzer on that place, a tired voice says, "Yeah?" And you say something like, "Well, could I just..." Oh, and they say, "Come on in." You know, because of course it gets thousands of visitors. And the buzzer sounds and he opens the door. And then a man comes out. He says, "This is where the lobby used to be. This is where the telephone was. This is where the bar used to be. This is where the telephone directory, the church directory used to be." And you go your own way. So it was a Mayflower hotel. At one end of the room stood a glass-covered directory of local churches. Down the lobby, a door opened into an attractive bar. He could see the gay crowd inside. And, of course, gay now is used to mean, you know, homosexual. There it didn't mean that, so you can see the language has changed a lot. In there, he would find companionship and release. Unless he took some drinks, he might not have the courage to scrape an acquaintance and would have a lonely weekend. Of course he couldn't drink, but why not sit hopefully at a table, a bottle of ginger ale before him? After all, had he not been sober 6 months now, perhaps he could handle, say, 3 drinks, no more. Fear gripped him. He was on thin ice. Again, it was the old insidious insanity, that first drink. With a shiver, he turned away and walked down the lobby to the church directory. Music and gay chatter still floated to him from the bar. But what about his responsibility, his family, and the men who would die because they would not know how to get well? Ah, yes, that's how Bill talked. Ah, yes, those other alcoholics. There must be many such in this town. He would phone a clergyman. His sanity returned, he thanked God. Selecting a church at random from the directory, he stepped into a booth and lifted the receiver. And he tells this story in more depth in a book called Alcoholics Anonymous Comes of Age, a brilliant, brilliant book that he wrote. He calls up a reverend named Walter Tunks, and he pours out his tale. He says, I asked if maybe he knew some people who put me in touch with another alcoholic. I thought he might know some of the Oxford groupers around Akron. He was, you know, remember, Bill was a member of the Oxford groups. He joined the Oxford groups because Ebby had sent him there. When the good man learned that I was an alcoholic looking for another alcoholic to work on, he at first apparently envisioned, saw 2 people drunk instead of one. But when he had finally got the point, he gave me a list of 10 people. So he gave me a list of 10 people. Bill called all those 10. They were all too busy. One was working on a sermon. One was going out of town. But they gave him a list of a few others. One of the members of that list was a woman named Henrietta Seiberling. And he didn't want to phone her up because he thought that she was the wife of a big rubber dealer, a rubber tire maker, Seiberling Rubber Tire Company. And he had met this Mr. Seiberling. He didn't want to call the wife. But finally, she was the only one left, so he called her up. And she turned out to be the daughter-in-law of the Seiberlings, who was estranged from the family because she and her husband were separated. She was living in the gatehouse of the Seiberling estate, this huge estate in Akron, Ohio. There's a picture of that gatehouse in the book that you can download on my website. And she said, "Come right over. I know exactly whom you should see." And he went over. She started talking to him about this wonderful doctor named Dr. Bob Smith. Everyone loved him. Everyone loved his wife, Anne. They were members of the Oxford groups. They had been members of the Oxford groups for a year and a half, 1 year longer than Bill had been a member of the Oxford groups. And everyone knew he was a drunk. And he had never admitted it until actually she, I heard her, there's a speech by her too, or talk by her, where she talked about how she engineered a disclosure. She had 4 or 5 other members of the Oxford groups in on it, and they organized a meeting where people would disclose their deepest secrets. So all these 4 people disclosed their deepest secrets, wanting Bob to reveal that he was a drunk. And he did. He revealed that he was a drunk. First time he'd ever revealed it after how many months or maybe years of being in the Oxford groups. It still didn't help him. He couldn't get sober. And he, of course, knew you get honest with yourself, you get honest with another human being, you make amends for the wrongs you've done, you pray to God for guidance in all things, you help others without hope of reward, property, or prestige. He knew all that, and yet he could not do it in a way that got him sober. So Henrietta Seiberling, Henry they called her, said, you know, I'll call up Dr. Bob and they'll come over, they'll talk to you. So she phones and she gets Anne on the phone and says, I am sorry, it's Mother's Day tomorrow and he just bought me a potted plant and we're just busy. She didn't mention that he was so drunk that he was underneath the plant, underneath the table, so potted. But they arranged to see him, they arranged for Dr. Bob and Anne to come over the next day for supper. So that's what happens. And Dr. Bob said, I made Anne promise me that I would spend only 15 minutes with this man. We would just do it for Henry, because everyone loved Henry. So they came at 5 o'clock on a Sunday afternoon, and they left at 11 o'clock. Bill actually gave him a bottle of beer to steady his nerves and took him into another room after supper. And what Bill said was this. He said, in our first conversation, I bore down heavily on the medical hopelessness of Dr. Bob's case, freely using Dr. Silkworth's words, describing the alcoholic's dilemma, the obsession plus the allergy. You can't stop once you've started, you can't stop from starting. Though Bob was a doctor, this was news to him, bad news. Always better versed in spiritual matters than I. I mean, he'd been a member of the Oxford Group for so long. He had paid little attention to that aspect of my story, I saw God, my hot flash, whatever. Even though he couldn't make them work, he knew what the spiritual answers were. Of course he did. What really hit him hard was the medical business, the verdict of inevitable annihilation, and the fact that I was an alcoholic and knew what I was talking about from personal experience made the blow a shattering one. In Dr. Bob's story, as afterwards written for the AA book, and years later in his last full-length talk at Detroit, he made this point very, very clear. It was not any spiritual teaching of mine. Rather, it was those twin ogres, the horrible demons. Well, ogres are, they're Scandinavian, aren't they? Aren't they? Norwegian, maybe? I don't know. Anyway, ogres. You know, people who are under bridges. Trolls. Of madness and death, the allergy plus the obsession that triggered him into a new life. It was Dr. Silkworth's idea, confirmed by William James, that struck him at great depth. And here's such an important paragraph. You see, our talk was a completely mutual thing. I had quit preaching. I knew I needed this alcoholic as much as he needed me. This was it. This mutual give and take is at the very heart of all of AA's 12-step work today. This was how to carry the message. The final missing link was located right there in my first talk with Dr. Bob. He needed Dr. Bob as much as Dr. Bob needed him. Probably more than Dr. Bob needed him, because Bill had been sober for 6 months and he was going to drink again if he didn't carry the message to another alcoholic. So he was no longer preaching from on high. He was talking with desperation, telling his story, not asking them to tell theirs. If you look at the directions in the big book, and I'm not going to go through them in great depth, they're in the big book and they're analyzed in that schematic outline, you will see a very brief, maybe 1 or 2 hour conversation. They talk about how to find one. They talk because, of course, there was no AA around, so you couldn't find them by going to meetings. You have to find one by going to doctors or to ministers and finding people who are drunk. And talk to the family, have them talk to after a spree. They say on page 90, paragraph 1, page 103 in the Danish version, let his family or friend ask him if he wants to quit for good and if he would go to any extreme to do so. If he says yes, then his attention should be drawn to you as a person who has recovered. Not is recovering, but has recovered. That there is a difference between you recovered from compulsive eating. You should be described to him as one of a fellowship who is part of their own recovery, trying to help others, and who will be glad to talk to him if he cares to see you. And I meet people on airplanes. Where are you going? If I see that they probably could use the program, I ask them where they're going, and then they ask me where I'm going. I will see people, and I'll get into a conversation with them, and if they show any interest in Overeaters Anonymous, I talk to them about it. if they say, I don't need it, but I have a cousin who needs it, or a brother, or whatever, I say, you know what? Here's my number, here's my my email address. Tell that person that it will do me more good than maybe it'll do to them, that I would love to talk to them. It would help me continue my recovery. And tell them that ice cream goes bad in my freezer and I don't care about it, and that's a miracle. And if they think that's a miracle, they'll know what I'm talking about. And then they say, if he wants to meet with you, meet with you. So you're not, no one's forcing them to meet. And the instructions are basically, tell your story. Tell your story in such a way that they begin to understand the allergy of the body and the obsession of the mind. Tell in such a way that you can talk about the times when you've eaten uncontrollably, and about the times when, even when you've been away from the stuff, and your mind has sent you back to it. And then begin to describe that. I wouldn't use the word allergy anymore. It means to, it doesn't mean enough, but I would talk about cravings and the abnormal reaction that you get. Contrast that with normal people who can't eat too much, even if they love it. Or if they eat too much one day, they can't eat the next day. And talk about how you've never had an empty, a full stomach, if that's true for you. Tell your story, not my story. And tell that story in such a way that they begin to that you don't call them alcoholics, but you call yourself not alcoholic. You don't call them a compulsive eater, but you call yourself a compulsive eater. And you say, I don't know if you're like me. You may not be like me. Don't make it easy to get in. Help them define themselves and help them become desperate if they are like you. They may not be like you. I have met people who have been overweight, who have lost weight by simply realizing they have to cut their portions down. And they've weighed a huge amount. And they lose weight simply by cutting their portions down. There are many people in this world, and there are many support groups in this world, who help people lose weight who do not need the 12 steps. They just give each other support, they meet each other, they weigh each other, and they lose weight. Lots of weight, little weight, it doesn't matter. Our fellowship is for people who cannot stop once they've started and who can't stop from starting. And that's how we tell the story. So you tell the story, and then they say, at a certain point, this prospect may be curious to know what you did. Then tell him the answer. Tell him, and don't spare him. You went through the inventory. You searched for spiritual awakening. But stress to him, he doesn't have to agree with your conception of God. I'm on page 93 of the book, or page 105, paragraph 1, probably going into paragraph 1 of the Danish edition. He can choose any conception he likes, provided it makes sense to him. The main thing is he'd be willing to believe in a power greater than himself. He lived by spiritual principles. Use everyday language to describe these spiritual principles. Do not use your particular religion or your particular God, because you would exclude that person if that person doesn't have your particular God. And then some more toughness. The person may be deeply religious, may know more about religion than you do. To that you say, you probably know more about religion than I do, but clearly your religion isn't working for you if, you know, your connection to God isn't working for you. Call to his attention, they say in this paragraph, page 93, paragraph 1 on page 106 of the Danish edition. Call to his attention the fact that however deep his faith and knowledge, he could not have applied it or he would not drink. Now, that's pretty tough language. Anyway, on page 94, page 106 of the Danish edition, paragraph 2. Outline the program of action, explaining how you made a self-appraisal, how you straightened out your past, and why you are now endeavoring to be helpful to him. It is important for him to realize that your attempt to pass this on to him plays a vital part in your own recovery. Actually, he may be helping you more than you are helping him. I have been asked to sponsor by people who left the program, and I'm grateful for them that they gave me the opportunity to sponsor them, even if they left the program. That's their problem, not mine. But I got a chance to carry the message. I got more insurance against the next slip. I got more spiritual recovery carrying the message. I gave of myself without hope of reward, property, or prestige. Let's read you a bit more from what Bill says. in his talk to doctors. He says, in fact, we aim to produce a crisis to cause him to hit bottom, as AA say. Do you have the expression hit bottom?
Yeah.
And I heard someone once say, you only hit bottom when you stop digging. You know, you could stop at 1 foot, or you could stop at 20 feet. You could stop at 10 kilos, 10 kilos to lose, or 300 kilos to lose. But you stop. When you stop, you've hit bottom. Of course, you will understand, Bill goes on, that this is all done by indirection. We never pronounce sentences, nor do we tell any alcoholic what he must do. We don't even tell him he's an alcoholic. Relating the seriousness of our own cases, we leave him to draw his conclusions. But once he has accepted the fact that he is an alcoholic, and the further fact that he is powerless to recover unaided, the battle is half won. As AA's have it, he's hooked, like a fish hook. He's caught as if in a psychological vice. You know, vice is something carpenters use to hold wood and stuff. If the jaws of it do not grip him tightly enough at first, more drinking will almost invariably always turn up the screw to the point where he will cry enough. Then, as we say, he is softened up. This reduces him to a state of complete dependence on whatever or whoever can stop his drinking. He's in exactly the same mental fix as the cancer patient who becomes dependent, abjectly, hopelessly dependent, if you will, on what you men of science, that's how we talked about doctors, on what you men of science do for cancer. Better still, I love this sentence, better still, he becomes sweetly reasonable, truly open-minded, as only the dying can be. And that's the seriousness with which we have to approach carrying the message. Because if we don't, people will not understand how serious it is. And it is serious. The big book then says, after it says you tell your story, tell them what you have to do, it says give them a copy of this book and leave. So we're talking about a 1 or 2 hour conversation at the most. Read the book. Remember Cassie's, read the book. And then if he is interested, the big book says, have a second meeting. If he's not interested, thank him for the opportunity and wish him well. If he is interested, it then says, on page 96, paragraph 2 of page 108, maybe it's paragraph 3, no, it's paragraph 2. He has read this volume and says he's prepared to go through with the 12 steps of the program of recovery. Having had the experience yourself, you can give him much practical advice. Let him know you're available if he wishes to make a decision, step 3, and tell his story, step 5. But don't insist upon it if he prefers to consult someone else. Now, just before, I'm going to talk about how I sponsor. But before I do, I want to talk about what the big book says about helping people. They talk about, do we help these people? Do we give them jobs? Do we give them homes? Do we feed them? Which is not something that most of us do and have to do in OA, because OA is generally pretty middle class. But do we help them in many ways? And they say, you can do that, but only do it if it's the right thing to do. And don't do it at the expense of your family, and don't do it because you think you should do it. Only do it because it seems to be the right thing. But if you have to, do it. You may have sleepless nights, you may be up all night helping people, but that's what your job is. But they go on page 98, paragraph 5 of page 109, of the Danish edition. It is not the matter of giving, not just read just above that, the paragraph before that. The men who cry for money and shelter before conquering alcohol are on the wrong track. And yet we do go to great extremes to provide each other with these various things when such action is warranted. This may seem inconsistent, but we think it is not. It is not the matter of giving that is in question, but when and how to give. That often makes the difference between failure and success. The minute we put our work on a service plane, doing things because they should be done, the alcoholic commences to rely upon our assistance, rather than upon God. He clamors for this or that, claiming he cannot master alcohol until his material needs are cared for. Nonsense, the shortest sentence in the big English version of the big book. Some of us have taken very hard knocks to learn this truth. Job or no job, wife or no wife, we simply do not stop drinking so long as we place dependence upon other people ahead of dependence on God. Burn the idea into the consciousness of every man that he can get well regardless of anyone. The only condition is that he trust in God and clean house. I take that really seriously. When I sponsor, I want no one to be dependent upon me. I want them to be dependent upon a higher power of their understanding. And so I have a very hands-off attitude to sponsoring. It means that I can sponsor many more people because they're responsible for keeping track of where they are in the program. It means I don't phone them. I don't ask them to phone me. Let's say they want to phone in their food to me, which often people will do and say, I need to phone in my food. I will say, you know, your phoning me isn't going to help me. I've recovered already. Why don't you pick a newcomer or someone else who's still suffering and ask that person if you could phone them and phone in your food to them? That'll help them as well as help you. And it'll double the quality of what you're doing. And they have done that, and it has helped them. I hardly use the telephone. I hate the telephone. The fact is, if you telephone me and I'm in front of a computer, I'm probably doing something on that computer while I'm on the phone with you. As a matter of fact, I just did a phone-in meeting about 2 months ago, and then there was a question-answer period after I did it. It was on step 12, and someone said, what do you think of the telephone? And I had to admit that while I was listening to the question, I was checking my email, because I was. That's why I hate the telephone. I'm always doing something. I use the telephone only to make appointments to meet people face to face. I have been asked to sponsor people long distance by email, by telephone, by Skype. I have great difficulties doing it because I find my concentration is just not there, and frankly, I'm not sure their concentration is there either. But certainly mine isn't. I suggest to people who ask me on a long distance to sponsor them is to find one other compulsive eater who shares their desperation and to help have them help each other work the steps. I'm always there to help them work out plans of eating. I'm there to help them if they need any advice on what the Big Book directions is or anything of that sort. But I've found it works. And I know that my doing things long distance will make people more dependent upon their contact with me than on their contact with their higher power. It's a good time to break, and then we'll come back at 1 o'clock. Thank you.